Welcome to The Brothers Karamazov and Friends, an audiobook disguised as a podcast. Each week we explore the endless pile of pages that comprise the greatest novel of all time, The Brothers Karamazov. We have three rules on TBKAF, and only three. Rule number one, there are no redos. Rule number two, you will receive no help with pronunciation. And rule number three, you have to do voices for the characters, all of them. We will read each week for exactly 1 hour and pick up the next week where we left off. This week we're joined by Melissa Taylor, a dear friend of the Mustard with the hands and feet of a child. Welcome to the Brothers Karamazov and Friends, Melissa.
Thank you. Hello.
We're very glad to have you here. As we mentioned, you do have very small hands and feet.
Yes.
Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well,
tell us why.
Imagine a regular people's hands and feet and then take off a couple inches, and that would be my hands and feet.
That is too bad.
Yes. So your feet are, what, a size 9.5?
10.5.
10.5. In women's shoes, that would be 12.5, which would be a tall foot for a woman. Long foot. I have a size 4, which is roughly 1/3 the size of your foot.
Oh.
Hmm.
That is unfortunate. Have you had difficulties walking and picking up things during your life?
Picking up, yes. I would say I've never been able to palm a basketball, like many of my contemporaries. But walking is so far proven okay.
But I bet you probably can't pick anything up with your feet.
Oh, only very small things.
Have you ever picked anything up with your feet?
Towels.
Let's go ahead and pick that up in the reading. We're going to go ahead and start on page 442. As you know, you will be doing the voice of Grushenka, who is a noblewoman, but perhaps with a not-so-noble reputation.
Hmm.
Go ahead and take it away.
Take me away! Take me away! Do you hear? I don't want to be here. I want to be far, far away.
Oh, yes, yes, we must. Mitya pressed her in his arms. I'll take you. We'll fly away. Oh, I'd give my whole life now for 1 year, if only I knew about that blood.
What blood? Krushenka repeated in bewilderment.
Nothing, Mitya growled. Grusha, you wanted to be honest, but I am a thief. I stole money from Katka. What shame, what shame.
From Katka? You mean the young lady? No, you didn't steal anything. Give it back to her. Take from me! Why are you shouting? All that's mine is yours now. What do we care about money? We'll just throw it away on a spree. It's bound to be so with the likes of us, and you and I had better go work on the land. I want to scrape the earth with my hands. We must work. Do you hear? Alyosha said so. I won't be a mistress to you. I'll be faithful. I'll be your slave. I'll work for you. We'll both go to the young lady. We'll bow to her and ask for her forgiveness and go away, and if she doesn't forgive us, we'll go away anyway, and you can give her back her money and love me. And not love her! You do not love her anymore. If you love her, I'll strangle her! I'll put both her eyes out with a needle!
I love you. You alone. I love you in Siberia.
Why in Siberia? But why not? I'll go to Siberia if you like. It's all the same. We'll work. There's snow in Siberia. I like driving over snow. And there should be a little sleigh bell. Do you hear a bell ringing? Where's that little bell ringing? People are driving. Now it's stopped.
She closed her eyes helplessly and suddenly seemed to fall asleep for a moment. A bell had indeed been ringing somewhere far away, and suddenly stopped ringing. Mitya lowered his head onto her breast. He did not notice how the bell stopped ringing, nor did he notice how the singing suddenly stopped as well. And instead of songs and drunken racket, a dead silence fell suddenly, as it were, over the whole house. Grushenka opened her eyes.
What? Was I asleep? Yes, the bell. I fell asleep and had a dream that I was driving over the snow. A bell was ringing, and I was dozing. It seemed I was driving with someone very dear to me. With you. Far, far away, I was embracing you and kissing you and pressing close to you as if I were cold and the snow was glistening. You know how the snow glistens at night, and there's a new moon, and you feel as if you're not on Earth. I woke up, and my dear was beside me. How good.
Beside you, Mitya murmured, kissing her dress, her breast, her hands. And suddenly, a strange fancy struck him. He fancied that she was looking straight ahead, not at him, not into his eyes, but over his head, intently and with a strange fixity. Surprise, almost fear, suddenly showed on her face.
Mitya, who is that looking at us from there? She whispered suddenly. Mitya turned and saw that someone had indeed parted the curtains and was apparently trying to make them out. More than one person, it seemed. He jumped up and quickly went toward the intruder.
"Here! Come out here! Please!"
someone's voice said to him, not loudly, but firmly and insistently.
Mitya stepped from behind the curtain and stood still. The whole room was full of people, not those who had been there before, but quite new ones. A momentary shiver ran down his spine and he drew back. He recognized all these people instantly. The tall, plump old man in a coat and a service cap with a cockade was the district police commissioner, Mikhail Makarich, and the trim, consumptive fop, always in such a well-polished boots, was the deputy prosecutor. He has a chronometer worth 400 rubles. He showed it to me. And the short young man in spectacles. Mitya simply could not remember his last name, but knew him, too. He had seen him. He was an attorney, a district attorney, from the jurisprudence recently arrived. And that one, the deputy commissioner, Mavriky Mavrikich. He knew him. He was an acquaintance. And the ones with badges. What were they doing here? And the other two peasants. And Kalganov and Trifon Burishish there in the doorway.
"Gentlemen, what is it, gentlemen?" Mitya started to say, but suddenly, as if beside himself, as if not of himself at all, he exclaimed loudly at the top of his lungs,
"I understand!"
The young man in spectacles suddenly came forward, and stepping up to Mitya, began in a dignified manner, though a little hurriedly, as it were.
"We must have, in short, would you kindly come over here to the sofa? It is the utmost necessity that we have a word with you."
"The old man!" Mitya cried in a frenzy. "The old man and his blood! I understand!"
And as if cut down, he fell more than sat on a chair standing nearby.
Sorry, I had to see who it was.
"You understand? He understands! Parasite and monster, your old father's blood cries out against you!"
The old district police commissioner suddenly roared, going up to Mitya. He was beside himself, turned purple, and was shaking all over.
"But this is impossible!" cried the short young man. "Mikhail Makarish! Mikhail Makarish! Not like that! Not like that, sir! I ask you to allow me to speak alone! I would never have expected such an episode from you!"
"But this is delirium, gentlemen! Delirium!" the police commissioner kept exclaiming. "Look at him! In the middle of the night with a disreputable wench!"
Not a wrench, a wench.
Covered with his father's blood! Delirium! Delirium!
"I beg you as strongly as I can, dear Mikhail Makarish, to restrain your feelings for a moment," the deputy prosecutor whispered rapidly to the old man. "Otherwise I shall have to resort to..."
But the short attorney did not let him finish. He turned to Mitya and firmly, loudly, and gravely declared,
"Retired Lieutenant Karamazov, sir, it is my duty to inform you that you are charged with the murder of your father, Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, which took place this night."
He said something more, and the prosecutor, too, seemed to add something, but Mitya, though he listened, no longer understood them. With wild eyes, he stared around at them all. Book 9, The Preliminary Investigation. We should probably pause here, because this is a big deal. Mitya was just arrested for murdering his father.
Egads!
Real crazy. Just as he was finally getting everything he wanted, and had won Grushenka over from his father and from everybody else. Turns out, he's going to jail.
Going to jail.
Classic.
Jeez.
Classic.
Timing.
Boy meets girl gets arrested for patricide. Story.
Of my life.
It would be a good time now to maybe turn to our other guest in the room. For our dear listeners at home who might not know, we are joined by two special friends this evening, in addition to Melissa. One Rachel Schwartz, and one dog.
Jackson.
Jackson.
The best dog in the world, who's currently asleep.
He has been in this room for some time and has yet to make a single sound since I have seen him. I don't think he's going to chime in on his thoughts. But Rachel, perhaps you could tell us, pretty much your thoughts on everything we've read so far.
I've been having a little bit of difficulty focusing on the content because I've been laughing at your voices.
Are you saying that our voices are absurd, or
no? They're just bringing a lot of joy to my life.
The voices were not meant to be humorous; merely realistic portrayals. Okay.
They're vessels to bring the characters to life.
I'm ashamed.
If you were Mitya, what would you do in this moment, Rachel?
I would probably get a Margarona.
As your last meal, or?
I'm not sure that will
be an option. Yeah, well, he's not going to get that option.
In Siberia.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, if it was me, I'd probably pull the semi-automatic that I was hiding in the couch cushions and try to, like, shoot my way to freedom.
Well, it is the mid-19th century, so they may not have had those.
Mm.
So, but it's a good, it's a good plan. Readers, at home, just let us know what you would do if you were Mitya in this situation. Would you go willingly to prison for your father's murder? Would you confess to it? Would you deny it? Would you murder Grushenka in a fit of delirium? Please go ahead and chime in on Twitter as you do every single week, and we look forward to hearing from you. We're going to go ahead and start Book 9, The Preliminary Investigation, Chapter 1, the start of the official Perkotin's career. And Melissa, go ahead and take it away.
Pyotr Ilyich Perkotin, whom we left knocking with all his might at the well-locked gates of the widow Morozov's house, in the end, of course, was finally successful. Hearing such furious knocking at the gate, Fenya, who had been so frightened 2 hours before and who was still too excited and thinking too much to dare to go to bed, became frightened once more, almost to the point of hysterics. She fancied that it was Dmitri Fyodorovich knocking again, though she herself had seen him drive off, because no one else but he would knock so boldly. She rushed to the awakened porter, who had heard the knocking and was already on his way to the gate, and began begging him not to open. But the porter made inquiries of the person who was knocking, and learned who he was, and that he wanted to see Fedosia Markovna on the very important matter, finally decided to open the gates for him, going to the same kitchen with Fedosia Markovna. And she, on account of her doubts, prevailed upon Pyotr Ilyich to allow the porter to come with them. Pyotr Ilyich started questioning her and at once hit upon the most important fact, namely, that Dmitri Fyodorovich, as he ran off to look for Grushenka, had snatched the pestle from the mortar and returned later without the pestle but with his hands covered in blood. And the blood was dripping. It kept dripping and dripping, Fenya exclaimed, her distraught imagination apparently having invented this horrible detail. But Pyotr Ilyich had seen those bloody hands himself, though the blood was not dripping, and had himself helped to wash them. And the question was not how soon the blood had dried, but where exactly Dmitri Fyodorovich had run with the pestle. That is, was it certain he had gone to Fyodor Pavlovich? And what might be the grounds for such a positive inference? Perkotin thoroughly emphasized this point, and though he did not find out anything definite as a result, he still became almost convinced that Dmitri Fyodorovich could not have run anywhere else but to his parents' house, and that, consequently, something must have happened there. And when he came back, Fenya added excitedly, and I told him everything, I began asking him, Dmitri Fyodorovich, my dear, why are your hands covered in blood? And he answered me that it was human blood, and that he had just killed a man. He simply admitted it. He simply confessed it all to me and suddenly ran out like a madman. I sat down and started thinking, where has he run off to like a madman? He'll go to Mokroya, I was thinking, and kill my mistress there. So I ran out to go to his place and beg him not to kill my mistress. But at Plotnikov's shop, I saw that he was already leaving and that his hands weren't covered with blood anymore. Fenya had noticed this and remembered it. The old woman, Fenya's grandmother, confirmed all her granddaughter's statements as far as she could, having asked a few more questions. Pyotr Ilyich left the house, even more troubled and worried than when he had entered it.
One would think that the most immediate and direct thing for him to do now would be to go to Fyodor Pavlovich's house and find out if anything had happened, and if so, what exactly, and being convinced beyond any doubt, only then to go to the police commissioner, as Pyotr Ilyich had firmly resolved to do. But the night was dark, the gates of Fyodor Pavlovich's house were strong. He would have to knock again, and he was only distantly acquainted with Fyodor Pavlovich. And so he would have to keep knocking until he was heard and the gates were opened, and what if suddenly nothing had happened at all and a jeering Fyodor Pavlovich were to go all over town tomorrow telling jokes about how a stranger, the official Prokotin, had forced his way into his house at midnight in order to find out if anyone had murdered him. A scandal. And there was nothing in the world Pyotr Ilyich feared more than a scandal. Nevertheless, he was moved by so strong a feeling that having angrily stamped his foot on the ground and given himself another scolding, he at once rushed on his way again, not to Fyodor Pavlovich's now, but to Madame Koklikov's. If she, he thought, would answer just one question, whether or not she had given Dmitri Fyodorovich 3,000 at such and such a time, then, in case the answer was negative, he would go straight to the police commissioner without going to Fyodor Pavlovich. Otherwise, he would put everything off until tomorrow and go back home. Here, of course, it is immediately obvious that the young man's decision to go at night, at almost 11 o'clock, to the house of a society lady who was a complete stranger to him, and perhaps get her out of bed in order to ask her an, under the circumstances, astonishing question, was perhaps much more likely to cause a scandal than going to Fyodor Pavlovich. I guess what I'm curious about is, he thinks Fyodor Pavlovich may have been murdered by Dmitri.
Yes.
But he's not going to go to Fyodor's house because he's worried it's going to cause a scandal.
Yeah.
But he might be dead.
Yeah.
It's like he's just going to leave him dead in the house overnight.
Yeah.
Potentially. Because he might not be dead.
Right.
The number one rule of crime scene investigation is take your time. Let the evidence sit for a while.
The first 24 hours are certainly not important.
No, not a big deal at all.
No.
What you should investigate first is all of the circumstantial evidence.
Yes.
And then you go to the physical evidence.
Yeah.
He's got a good start to his career here. But it sometimes happens that way, especially in such cases, with the decisions of the most precise and phlegmatic people. And at the moment, Pyotr Ilyich was far from... And at the moment, Pyotr Ilyich was far from phlegmatic. He remembered afterwards all his life how their irresistible anxiety that gradually took possession of him finally became so painful that it carried him along even against his will. Naturally, he kept scolding himself all the way, in any case, for going to this lady, but... "I'll go through with it! I'll go through with it!" he repeated for the 10th time, clenching his teeth. And he did as he intended. He went through with it.
It was exactly 11 o'clock when he came to Madame Kolkolov's house. He was promptly let into the yard, but to his question, "Is the lady asleep or has she gone to bed yet?" the porter could give no precise answer, beyond saying that at that hour people usually go to bed. "Ask to be announced upstairs. If the lady wants to receive you, she will. If she won't, she won't." Pyotr Ilyich went to the door, but there things became more difficult. The lackey did not want to announce him, and finally called the maid. Pyotr Ilyich politely but insistently asked her to inform the lady that a town official, Prokotin, had come on special business, and were the business not so important, he would not have ventured to come. "Inform her precisely, precisely in those words," he asked the maid. She left. He stood waiting in the front hall. Okay, here's my question. He's now had to be very insistent with a lot of people. Again, a lady, and this is now late at night, and it was going to cause more of a scandal than going to, as far as I'm aware, he was a reprobate. He was an old reprobate.
Yes.
Who was possibly baby murdered.
Yeah.
Okay, well, the guy's an imbecile, naturally.
Baby murdered? Is that a term?
Maybe murdered.
Oh, maybe. I thought you said baby murdered.
No, maybe.
Like, he that's may a thing when you get murdered by your child.
It's just a baby murder.
Just
not a full-grown murder, but a baby.
This seems like a classic case of baby murder. Which is not what it sounds like. It's when a child murders their parent. Yeah.
Yeah. Naturally. Okay. Madame Kolkolov, though not yet asleep, had already retired to her bedroom. She had been upset since Mitya's visit, and now anticipated that she would not get through the night without the migraine that was usual for her in such cases. On hearing the maid's report, she was surprised, and yet she irritably told her to refuse, though the unexpected visit at such an hour of a town official quite unknown to her greatly piqued her woman's curiosity. But this time, Pyotr Ilyich was stubborn as a mule. Hearing the refusal, he once again asked the maid very insistently to inform her mistress and tell her precisely in these very words that he had come on extremely important business and the lady herself might regret if later she did not receive him now. It was like throwing myself on a mountain. He he afterward recounted. The maid, having looked him over in surprise, went to announce him again. Madame Kolkolov was amazed, thought for a moment, inquired about his appearance, learned that he was very properly dressed, young and so polite. Let us note, parenthetically, that in passing, that Pyotr Ilyich was quite a handsome young man, and was aware of it himself. Madame Kolkolov decided to come out. She was already in her dressing gown and slippers, but she threw a black shawl over her shoulders. The official was shown into the drawing room, the very room where she had just recently received Mitya. The hostess came to meet her visitor with a sternly inquiring look, and without inviting him to sit down, began straight off with the question, "What is it you want?"
"I have ventured to trouble you, madam, in connection with our mutual acquaintance, Dmitri Fyodorovich Karamazov,"
Perkotin began. But as soon as he spoke this name, his hostess's face suddenly showed the greatest irritation. She all but shrieked and furiously interrupted him.
"How long? How long must I be tormented with that awful man?" she cried in frenzy. "How dare you, my dear sir? How could you venture this herb lady, not of your acquaintance, in her own house and in such an hour, and come to her to speak of a man who right here in this very drawing room just 3 hours ago came to murder me, stamped his feet, walked out as no one walks out of a decent house? Let me tell you, my dear sir, that I will lodge a complaint against you. I will not stand for it. Now kindly leave my house at once. I am a mother. I shall...
"Murder? So he wanted to murder you, too?"
"Why? Did he already murder someone else?" Madame Kolkolov asked impetuously.
"Be so good, madame, as to listen for only half a minute, and I shall explain everything in 2 words,
Perkotin answered firmly.
"Today, at 5 o'clock in the afternoon, Mr. Karamazov borrowed 10 rubles from me as a friend, and I knew for certain that he had no money. Yet this same day, at 9 o'clock, he walked into my rooms holding out for all to see a wad of 100-ruble bills, approximately 2,000 or even 3,000 rubles. His hands and face were all covered with blood, and it appeared as if he were mad. To my question as to where he got so much money, he replied with precision that he had just received it from you, and that you had loaned him the sum of 3,000 rubles to go, he said, to the gold mines."
Madame Kolkolov's face suddenly acquired a look of extraordinary and morbid excitement.
"Oh, God! He's murdered his old father!"
she cried out, clasping her hands.
"I gave him no money, none! Oh, run, run! Not a word more! Save the old man! Run to his father, run!"
"I beg your pardon, madame. So you did not give him any money? You firmly recall that you did not give him any?"
"I did not! I did not! I refused because he was unable to appreciate it! He walked out furious and stamped his feet. He rushed at me, but I jumped aside. And I shall also tell you, as a man from whom I now have no intention of concealing anything, that he even spat at me. Can you imagine it? But why are you standing? Oh, do sit down. Forgive me, Oh, no, run, run. You must run and save the unfortunate old man from a horrible death."
"But if he has already killed him?"
"Ah, my God, of course. What are we going to do now? What do you think we should do now?"
Meanwhile, she sat Pyotr Ilyich down, and sat down herself, facing him. Pyotr Ilyich gave her a brief but rather clear account of the affair, at least that part of the affair he himself had witnessed earlier. He also told her of his visit to Fenya, and mentioned the news of the pestle. All these details struck the agitated lady no end, so she kept crying out and covering her eyes with her hands.
"Imagine! I foresaw it all! I am endowed with this property! Whatever I imagine always happens! How often have I looked at that terrible man and thought, here is a man who will end up by murdering me, and now it's happened. That is, if he hasn't killed me now, but only his father, it is most likely because the hand of God is so obviously protecting me. And besides, he was ashamed to murder me because I myself, here on this very spot, put an icon around his neck with a relic of the great martyr Varvara. How close I was to death at that moment! I went up to him quite close, and he stretched out his neck to me. You know, Pyotr Ilyich, forgive me, you did say your name was Pyotr Ilyich. You know, I do not believe in miracles, but this icon and this obvious miracle with me now, it astounds me, and I'm beginning to believe in anything again. Have you heard about the elder Zosima? Anyway, I don't know what I'm saying. And imagine, even with the icon on his neck, he still spat at me. Of course, he only spat, he didn't murder me, and so that's what he galloped off to. But what of us? Where shall we go now? What do you think?"
Pyotr Ilyich stood up and announced that he would go now directly to the police commissioner and tell him everything and let him do as he thinks best.
"Ah, he is a wonderful, wonderful man. I know Mikhail Makarovich. Of course, go precisely to him. How resourceful you are, Pyotr Ilyich, and what a good idea you've come up with. You know, in your place, I'd never have been able to come up with that.
All the more so in that I, too, am well acquainted with the commissioner, observed Pyotr Ilyich, still standing and evidently wishing somehow to tear himself away from the impetuous lady, who would not let him say goodbye and leave her.
And you know, she went on prattling, you must come back and tell me what you see and learn, and what they find out, and what they will decide about him, and where they will condemn him to. Tell me, we don't have capital punishment, do we? But you must come, even if it's 3 o'clock in the morning. Even if it's 4. Even 4:30. Tell them to wake me, to shake me if I don't get up. Oh, God, but I'll never be able to fall asleep. You know, why don't I go with you myself?
No, madame, but if you would now write 3 lines in your own hand, just in case, saying you did not give Dmitri Fedorovich any money, it might not be amiss, just in case.
Certainly, the delighted Madame Koklikov leaped to her bureau. And you know, you amaze me. You simply astound me with your resourcefulness and your skill in these matters. Are you in service here? I'm so pleased to know you're in service here.
And while she spoke, she quickly inscribed the following 3 lines in a large hand on a half sheet of writing paper. Never in my life did I lend the unfortunate Dmitri Fedorovich Karamazov, for he is unfortunate now in any case, the sum of 3,000 rubles today, or any other money, never, never. I swear to it by all that is holy in our world, Koklikov.
Here is the note, she turned quickly to Pyotr Ilyich. Go now and save. It is a great deed on your part.
And she crossed him 3 times. She even ran out to see him to the front hall.
How grateful I am to you. You wouldn't believe how grateful I am to you now for having come to me first. How is it we've never met? I shall be flattered to receive you in my house in the future. And how pleased I am now to know you're in service here. And with your precision, your resourcefulness, they must appreciate you. They must finally understand you. And whatever I can do for you, believe me. Oh, I love young people so. I'm in love with young people. Young people, they are the foundation for all of today's suffering Russia, her only hope. Oh, go!
But Pyotr Ilyich had already run out, otherwise she would not have let him go so soon. All the same, Madame Koklikov made quite a pleasant impression on him, which even somewhat softened his alarm at getting involved in such a bad affair. Tastes are extremely divergent, that is a known fact. She's not as old as that, he thought with pleasure. On the contrary, I might have taken her for her own daughter.
As for Madame Koklikov, she was simply enchanted with the young man.
Such skill, such exactitude, and in such a young man in our time, and all that with manners and appearance. And yet they say our modern young men cannot do anything, but here's an example for you,
and so on and so forth. So that she simply forgot all about the terrible incident, and only on the point of going to bed did she suddenly recall again how close she had been to death.
Ah, she said, it's terrible, terrible,
and at once fell into a sound and sweet sleep. By the way, I would not go into such petty and incidental details if the eccentric encounter I have just described between a young official and a widow not all that old had not afterwards served as the foundation for the whole life's career of that precise and accurate young man, which is still recalled with astonishment in our town, and of which we too shall perhaps have a special word to say once we have concluded our long story of the Karamazov brothers.
I would like to note at this point that she, not being a very old widow, saying that she is in love with the young people, it's good that she was fairly general about being in love with young people is fine. If she had been very specific, I love 12-year-old boys, for instance, that would be where it gets some tricky. That would be too young and very specific. But if it's general, it's okay.
Yeah, she made a wise decision to not admit to pedophilia in
yeah.
that moment.
Yeah.
That was a good choice on her part.
Yeah.
Chapter 2, The Alarm.
Our district commissioner of police, Mikhail Markarovich Makarov, a retired lieutenant colonel, redesignated a state councillor, was a widower and a good man. He had come to us only 3 years earlier, but had already won general sympathy mainly because he knew how to bring a society together. His house was never without guests, and it seemed he would have been unable to live without them. He had to have guests to dinner every day, even if only 2, even if only 1. But without guests, he would not sit down to eat. He gave formal dinners too. Under all sorts of pretexts, sometimes even the most unexpected, the food he served, though not refined, was abundant. The cabbage pies were excellent, and the wines made up in quantity for what they lacked in quality.
What is a cabbage pie?
is the crust made of cabbage, or is it only cabbage in the middle?
I don't know.
Sounds
that
awful.
Would just be a bad surprise if you cut into your pie and...
Ooh, cherry, my favorite!
Found a bunch of...
Cabbage.
Cabbage. Again.
Smells like...
Maybe it's like a runza.
Thanks, Mikhail.
Maybe it's like a runza.
Maybe it is like a runza, but without...
With more cabbage.
All of the...
Maybe not conveniently handheld.
For those of our listeners who are not from the great state of Nebraska, a runza is a Czech dish, I think. I mean, it's a fast food restaurant in Nebraska, but it's... The item is, I think, a Czech dish. And it's just basically bread with meat and cabbage inside. And it's actually pretty good. But I think that has something to do with the fact that it isn't full of cabbage.
There's
I'm guessing if it was, like, all cabbage inside, I might not like it so much.
Especially since the cabbage is what... It's not fermented, because that's kimchi. But is it pickled? It's gross cabbage. Mm. It's not, like, regular cabbage. Is it really? I thought it was... What's that thing that you guys do with the cabbage when it gets old and yucky, but you eat it anyway? It's a very Midwestern thing. I never had it before we came here. Nope, nobody?
I don't know.
Nobody
I'm
knows
not sure
about that?
Never. You know, next week we're going to try to bring on an expert in Russian cuisine, and we'll ask all about cabbage pies.
Cabbage pies.
So you're just going to have to tune in next week, dear listeners, to find out about the delicacies of cabbage pie.
Cabbage pie.
And onward.
Onward. In the front room stood a billiard table, surrounded by quite decent furnishings. That is, there were even paintings of English racehorses in black frames on the wall, which, as everyone knows, constitute a necessary adornment of any billiard room in a bachelor's house. Every evening there was a card game, even if only at one table, but quite often all the best society of our town, including mamas and young girls, would get together there for a dance. Mikhail Makarovich, though a widower, lived as a family man with his already long-widowed daughter, who in turn was the mother of two girls, Mikhail Makarovich's granddaughters. The girls were grown up by then and had finished their education. They were not unattractive appearance. They were not... What? They were of not unattractive appearance, of cheerful character. And though everyone knew that they would bring no dowries, they still drew our young men of society to their grandfather's house. In his official capacity, Mikhail Makarovich was none too bright, but he did his job no worse than many others. To tell the truth, he was rather an uneducated man, and even a bit carefree with respect to a clear understanding of the limits of his administrative power. Not that he did not fully comprehend some of the reforms of the present reign, but he understood them with certain, sometimes quite conspicuous, mistakes. And not all because he was somehow especially incapable, but simply because of his carefree nature, because he never got around to looking into them. "I have the soul of a military man, not a civilian," he said to himself. He still did not seem to have acquired a firm and definite idea even to the exact principles of the peasant reform, and learned of them, so to speak, from year to year, increasing his knowledge practically and unwittingly, though, by the way, he himself was a landowner. Pyotr Ilyich knew with certainty that he was sure to meet some guest at Mikhail Makarovich's that evening. Only he did not know exactly whom. Meanwhile, at that very moment, the prosecutor and our district doctor, Varvinsky, a young man who had just come to us from Petersburg, after brilliantly completing his studies at the Petersburg Medical Academy, were sitting there playing whist. The prosecutor, Ippolit Kirillovich, the deputy prosecutor, that is, but we also all called him the prosecutor, was a special man among us, not old, still not above 35, but much inclined to consumption, and married, besides, to a rather fat and childless lady. He was proud, and irritable, and yet of quite considerable intelligence and even a kind soul. It appeared the whole trouble with his character was that he had somewhat higher opinion of himself than his real virtues warranted, and that was why he constantly seemed restless. Besides, there were in him certain lofty and even artistic pretensions. For example, to psychologism, to a special knowledge of the human soul, to a special gift of comprehending the criminal and his crime. In this sense, he considered himself somewhat ill-treated and passed over in his service, and was forever persuaded that they were unable to appreciate him in higher spheres and that he had enemies. In his gloomier moments, he even threatened to desert the defense side of criminal law. The unexpected case of the Karamazov parricide, not patricide, but parricide, thoroughly shook him. As it were. A case like this could become known all over Russia. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
In the next room, with the girls, there also sat our young district attorney, Nikolai Parfenovich Nelyudov, who had come to our town from Petersburg only 2 months earlier. Afterwards, everyone talked of it and even marveled that all these persons should have come together as if on purpose on the evening of the crime in the house of the executive authority. Yet it was a perfectly simple thing and happened quite naturally. It was the second day that Ippolit Kirillovich's wife had had a toothache, and he absolutely had to flee somewhere from her groaning. As for the doctor, by his very nature, he could do nothing of an evening but play cards. And Nikolai Parfenovich Nelyudov had already been planning for 3 days to visit Mikhail Makarovich that evening, inadvertently, so to speak, in order suddenly and perfidiously to startle the older girl, Olga Mikhailovna, with the fact that he knew her secret, that he knew it was her birthday, and that she had decided purposely to conceal it from our society so as not to invite people for dancing. Much laughter was in store, much hinting at her age, that she was supposedly afraid to reveal it, that he, now being in possession of her secret, would tell everyone tomorrow, and so on and so forth. The dear young man was very naughty in this respect. Our ladies, in fact, called him a naughty boy, and he seemed to like it very much. However, he was of quite good society, good family, good upbringing, and good feelings, a bon vivant with quite an innocent one, and always proper. Physically, he was short and of weak, delicate constitution. Several extremely large rings always flashed on his thin and pale fingers. When performing his duties, he became remarkably solemn, as though he conceived of his significance and responsibility as sacred. He was especially good at throwing murderers and other low-class criminals off guard in interrogations, and actually aroused in them, if not respect for himself, at least a certain astonishment.
When Pyotr Ilyich entered the commissioner's house, he was simply astounded. He suddenly saw that they knew everything already. Indeed, they had abandoned their cards. They all stood arguing, and even Nikolai Parfenovich came running from the young ladies with the most pugnacious and impetuous look on his face. Pyotr Ilyich was met with the astounding news that old Fyodor Pavlovich had really and truly been murdered in his house that evening, murdered and robbed. It had been learned just a moment before in the following way.
So we are going to examine how everyone came to know that Fyodor had been murdered. But we do need to pause and point out the fact that Nikolai Parfenovich came over only to...
make fun of a woman for her age?
No, only to make fun of the fact that he knew it was her birthday. The making fun of her age was part of it, but he really wanted to come over just so that he could tell her that he knew it was her birthday.
Nah, it's your birthday.
Which is normal.
It's a very common thing.
That's a thing.
My friends often do that to me. But really, I mean, she was pretty selfish, trying to hide her birthday so that she wouldn't have dancing.
Yeah.
How?
She probably wanted to keep all the cake, too.
All to herself.
Selfish.
Unbelievable.
In the meantime, Pyotr Ilyich has just gotten over here, and thankfully everyone else found out that Fyodor was murdered, so he didn't have to sit and rot in his own house for a full day, because Pyotr Ilyich didn't know. Marfa Ignatievna, the wife of Grigory, who had been struck down at the fence, though she was fast asleep in her bed and might have gone on sleeping like that until morning, nevertheless suddenly woke up. Conducive to that end was a terrible epileptic scream from Smerdyakov, who lay unconscious in the next room. That scream with which his fits of falling sickness always began, and that always all her life frightened Marfa Ignatievna terribly and had a morbid effect on her. She simply never could get used to it. Half awake, she jumped up and, almost beside herself, rushed to Smerdyakov in his little room. It was dark there. She could only hear that the sick man had been struggling and gasping horribly. Marfa Ignatievna screamed herself and began calling her husband, but suddenly realized that when she had gotten up, Grigory seemed not to be in bed. She ran back and felt in the bed again, but it was indeed empty. So he had got out, but where? She ran to the porch and timidly called him. She got no answer, of course, but instead she heard in the night's silence some groans, which seemed to be coming from somewhere far away in the garden. She listened. The groans were repeated, and it became clear that they were indeed coming from the garden.
"Lord, just like the stinking Lizaveta!"
flashed through her distraught head. She went timidly down the steps and saw that the garden gate was open.
"He must be there, the poor dear!"
she thought, going up to the gate, and suddenly she clearly heard Grigory calling her, crying out,
"Marfa! Marfa!"
in a weak, wailing, woeful voice.
Lord, keep us from disaster, Marfa Ignatievna whispered and rushed towards the voice, and in that way she found Grigory. But she found him not by the fence, not on the spot where he had been struck down, but about 20 paces away. Later, it turned out that having come to his senses, he had begun crawling, and probably crawled for a long while, losing consciousness and passing out several times more. She noticed at once that he was all covered with blood, and at that began screaming to high heaven. Grigory kept murmuring softly and incoherently.
He killed father. Killed. Stop shouting, fool. Run. Tell.
But Marfa Ignatievna would not quiet down and went on screaming, and suddenly, seeing that the master's widow was open and there was light in window was open and there was light inside, she ran to it and began calling Fyodor Pavlovich. But, looking through the window, she saw a terrible sight. The master was lying on his back on the floor, not moving. The front of his light-colored dressing gown and his white shirt were soaked with blood. A candle on the table shed a bright light on the blood and on the motionless, dead face of Fyodor Pavlovich. Now horrified to the last degree, Marfa Ignatievna rushed away from the window, ran out of the garden, unlocked the gates, and ran like mad through the back lane to her neighbor, Maria Kondratievna. Both neighbors, mother and daughter, were asleep by then, but at Marfa Ignatievna's urgent and frenzied shouting and knocking on the shutters, they woke up and jumped to the window. Marfa Ignatievna, shrieking and shouting, conveyed the essentials, however incoherently, and called for help. As it happened, that night the wandering Foma was staying with them. They roused him at once, and all three ran to the scene of the crime. On the way, Maria Kondratievna managed to recall that earlier, before 9 o'clock, she had heard a terrible and piercing cry from their garden, which could be heard all over the neighborhood. And this certainly was precisely the cry of Grigory as he caught hold of the leg of Dmitri Fyodorovich, who was already sitting astride the fence, and cried out, "Parricide!" Some one person shouted and suddenly stopped, Maria Kondratievna testified as she ran. Having come to the place where Grigory lay, the two women, with the help of Foma, carried him to the cottage. They lighted a candle and saw that Smerdyakov had still not calmed down, but was struggling in his little room, with eyes crossed and foam running from his lips. Grigory's head was washed with water and vinegar. The water brought him back to his full senses, and he asked at once,
"Has the master been killed?"
The two women and Foma then went to the master's, and this time saw, as they entered the garden, that not only the window, but the door to the garden was wide open. Whereas, for the whole past week, the master had been locking himself up securely in the evening every night and would not allow even Grigory to knock for him under any circumstances.
Well, that's proof positive. I mean, if anything else. Besides the blood and the dead face, the open door is clearly indicative.
Somebody.
Of a murder. Yeah.
Seeing the door open, all of them, the two women and Foma, were afraid to go to the master's room. For fear something might come of it afterwards. Grigory, when they came back, told them to run at once to the police commissioner himself. It was at this point that Maria Kondratievna ran and gave the alarm to everyone at the commissioner's house. She preceded Pyotr Ilyich's arrival by only 5 minutes, so that he came not just with his own guesses and conclusions, but as an obvious witness whose story even further confirmed the general surmise as to the identity of the criminal, which he, by the way, in the bottom of his heart, till this last moment, still refused to believe.
It was decided to act energetically. The assistant police chief was immediately ordered to round up as many as 4 witnesses, and following all of the rules, which I am not going to describe here, they penetrated Fyodor Pavlovich's house, and carried out an investigation on the spot. The district doctor, a hot and new man, all but invited himself to accompany the commissioner, the prosecutor, and the district attorney. I will give only a brief outline. Fyodor Pavlovich turned out to be thoroughly murdered, his head having been smashed in. But with what? Most likely with the same weapon with which Grigory had also been struck later. And just then they found the weapon, having heard from Grigory, to whom all possible medical help was administered, a quite coherent, though weakly and falteringly uttered account of how he had been struck down. They began searching near the fence with a lantern and found the brass pestle, thrown right on the garden path for all to see. No usual disorder was noted in the room where Fyodor Pavlovich was lying, but behind the screen near his bed, they picked up a big envelope from the floor, made of heavy paper, of official size, inscribed, "A little treat of 3,000 rubles for my angel Grushenka, if she wants to come." And below that was added, much likely later, by Fyodor Pavlovich himself, "And to my cheeky." There were 3 big seals of red wax on the envelope, but it had already been torn open and was empty. The money was gone. They also found on the floor a narrow pink ribbon with which the envelope had been tied. One circumstance, among others in Pyotr Ilyich's evidence, made an extraordinary impression on the prosecutor and the district attorney. Namely, his guess that Dmitri Fyodorovich would certainly shoot himself towards dawn, that he had resolved to do it, spoken of it to Pyotr Ilyich, loaded his pistol, and so on and so forth. And that when he, Pyotr Ilyich, still unwilling to believe him, had threatened to go and tell someone to prevent the suicide, Mitya had answered him, grinning, "You won't have time." It followed that they had to hurry there, to Mokroya, in order to catch the criminal before he, perhaps, really decided to shoot himself. "That's clear! That's clear!" the prosecutor kept repeating in great excitement. "That's just how it would with such hotheads! Tomorrow I'll kill myself, but before I die, a spree!" The story of his taking a lot of wine and provisions from the shop aroused the prosecutor even more. "Do you remember, gentlemen, the fellow who killed the merchant, Olsufyev? Robbed him of 1,500 and went on at once to have his hair curled, and then, without even hiding the money very well, almost holding it in his hand in the same way, went to the girls?" They were detained, however, by the investigation, the search of Fyodor Pavlovich's house, the paperwork, and so on. All this needed time, and therefore they sent to Mokroya, 2 hours ahead of them, the deputy commissioner, Mavriky Mavrikyevich Shmertsov, who had been in town just the previous morning to collect his salary. Mavriky Mavrikyevich was instructed to go to Mokroya, and without raising an alarm, to keep watch on the criminal, tirelessly, until the arrival of the proper authorities, as well as to procure witnesses, deputies, and so forth, and so on. And all this Mavriky Mavrikyevich did, preserving his incognito, and initiating only Trifon Borisovich, his old acquaintance, and then, only partially, into the secret of the affair. This coincided precisely with the time when Mitya met the innkeeper in the darkness on the porch, looking for him, and at once noticed a sudden change in Trifon Borisovich's face and tone. Thus, neither Mitya nor anyone else knew that he was being watched. His case with the pistols had long since been spirited away by Trifon Borisovich and hidden in some safe place, and only after 4 o'clock in the morning, almost at dawn, did all the authorities arrive, the police commissioner, the prosecutor, the district attorney, in two carriages, drawn by two troikas. The doctor stayed behind in Fyodor Pavlovich's house with the object of performing a post-mortem in the morning on the body of the murdered man. But above all, he'd become particularly interested in the condition of the sick servant, Smerdyakov. Such severe and protracted fits of the falling sickness, recurring uninterruptedly for about over 2 days, are rarely met with. This case belongs to science, he said excitedly to his departed companions, and they laughingly congratulated him on his find. At the same time, the prosecutor and the district attorney remembered very clearly the doctor, adding in the most definite tone that Smerdyakov would not live till morning.
Now, after a long but, I believe, necessary explanation, we have returned precisely to that moment of our story at which we stopped in the previous book. Chapter 3, The Soul's Journey Through Torments, The First Torment.
And so Mitya was sitting and staring around with wild eyes at those present, without understanding what was being said to him. Suddenly he rose, threw up his hands, and cried loudly,
"Not guilty! Of that blood I am not guilty! Of my father's blood I am not guilty! I wanted to kill him, but I am not guilty! Not me!"
But no sooner had he cried than that Grushenka jumped out from behind the curtains and simply collapsed at the feet of the police commissioner.
"It's me! Me, the cursed one! I am guilty!" she cried in a heartrending howl, all in tears, stretching her arms out to everyone. "It's because of me that he killed him! I tormented him and drove him to it! I tormented that poor old dead man, too, out of spite, and drove things to this! I am the guilty one, first and most of all! I am the guilty one!"
"Yes, you are the guilty one! You are the chief criminal! You are violent, you are depraved, you are the guilty one, and you most of all!" screamed the commissioner, shaking his finger at her, but this time he was quickly and resolutely suppressed. The prosecutor even seized him with both arms.
"This is entirely out of order, Mikhail Makarovich," he cried. "You are positively hindering the investigation, ruining the whole thing." He was all but choking.
"Measures, measures, we must take measures." Nikolai Parfenovich, too, had begun seething terribly. "Otherwise it's positively impossible."
"Judge us together,"
Grushenka went on, exclaiming frenziedly, still on her knees.
"Punish us together. I'll go with him now, even to execution."
"Grusha, my life, my blood, my holy one." Mitya threw himself on his knees beside her and caught him tightly to his arms. "Don't believe her," he shouted. "She's not guilty of anything, of any blood or anything!"
He remembered afterwards that several men pulled him away from her by force, that she was suddenly taken out, and that when he came to his senses, he was already sitting at the table. Beside him and behind him stood people with badges. On the sofa, across the table from him, Nikolai Parfenovich, the district attorney, sat trying to persuade him to sip some water from a glass that stood on the table.
It will refresh you. It will calm you down. You needn't be afraid. You needn't worry, he kept adding with extreme politeness.
And Mitya, as he remembered, suddenly became terribly interested in his big rings, one with an amethyst and another with a bright yellow stone, transparent and of a most wonderful brilliance. And for a long time afterwards, he recalled with surprise how these rings irresistibly drew his eye, even through all those terrible hours of interrogation, so that for some reason he was unable to tear himself away and forget them as something quite unsuitable in his position. On the left, at Mitya's side, where Maximov had been sitting at the start of the evening, the prosecutor now sat. And to Mitya's right, where Grushenka had been, a pink-cheeked young man settled himself, dressed in a rather threadbare sort of hunting jacket, and in front of him appeared an inkstand and some paper. He turned out to be the district attorney's clerk, who had come with him. The police commissioner now stood near the window, at the other end of the room, next to Kalganov, who was sitting in a chair by the window.
"Drink some water," the district attorney gently repeated for the 10th time.
"I drank some, gentlemen. I drank some, but... Come, gentlemen, crush me, punish me, decide my fate," Mitya exclaimed, staring with horribly fixed, bulging eyes at the district attorney.
"So you positively assert that you are not guilty of the death of your father, Fyodor Pavlovich?" the district attorney asked gently but insistently.
"Not guilty. I'm guilty of other blood, of another old man's blood, but not of my father's, and I weep for it. I killed the old man, killed him and struck him down. But it's hard to have to answer for that blood with this other blood, this terrible blood, which I'm not guilty of. A terrible accusation, gentlemen, and if you'd stunned me on the head. But who killed my father? Who killed him? Who could have killed him if not me? It's a wonder, an absurdity, an impossibility."
"Yes, who could have killed him?" the district attorney began, but the prosecutor, Ippolit Kirillovich, the deputy prosecutor, but for the sake of brevity, we too shall call him the prosecutor, exchanged glances with the district attorney, turning to Mitya.
So which...
I'm confused that for brevity he's dropping off just the deputy prosecutor. I mean, he's a Russian novelist. Now he's worried about brevity?
Nikolai Parfenovich. Hmm. Is he the prosecutor? Or the district attorney? Or is he somebody else?
He's the district attorney.
He's the district attorney?
I think so.
Okay. And this person who's about to speak is...
the deputy, but for brevity, prosecutor.
Okay. All right, so the prosecutor from now on is Ippolit Kirillovich. And then the really thin guy with the rings is the district attorney.
Yep.
And that is Nikolai
Parfenovich.
Okay. Just trying to keep it straight because we're about to do some real voices here.
Real voices.
"You needn't worry about the old servant, Grigory Vasilyev. I can tell you that he is alive. He has recovered, and despite the severe beating inflicted by you, according to his and now to your own evidence, it seems he will undoubtedly live, at least in the doctor's opinion."
"Alive? So he is alive?" Mitya suddenly shouted, clasping his hands. His whole face lit up. "Lord, I thank you for this greatest miracle, what you have done for me, a sinner and evildoer, according to my prayer." Yes, it was according to my prayer. I was praying all night. He crossed himself 3 times. He was nearly breathless.
"And it is from this same Grigory that we have received such significant evidence regarding you that..."
the prosecutor went on, but Mitya suddenly jumped up from his chair.
"One moment, gentlemen, for God's sake, one moment. I'll run to her." Spanish. Suddenly.
"Sorry, right now it's quite impossible," Nikolai Parfenovich almost shrieked, and he too
jumped to his feet. The men with badges laid hold of Mitya. However, he sat down on the chair himself.
"What a pity, gentlemen. I wanted to see her for just one moment. I wanted to announce to her that this blood that was gnawing at my heart all night has been washed away, disappeared. I'm no longer a murderer. She's my fiancée, gentlemen." He suddenly spoke ecstatically and reverently, looking all around them. "Oh, thank you, gentlemen. Oh, how you have restored, how you have resurrected me in a moment. That old man, he carried me in his arms, gentlemen. He washed me in a tub."
What has happened to your voice?
I don't know. When I was a three-year-old child and abandoned by everyone, he was my own father.
And so you, the district attorney began.
Mika took his hands away from his face. Sorry. Jim. Wow. Sorry. Okay. Sorry, gentlemen. Sorry. Just one more minute. Mitya interrupted, putting both elbows on the table and covering his hands with his face. Let me collect myself a little. Let me catch my breath, gentlemen. It is all terribly shocking, terribly. A man is not a drumskin, gentlemen.
Have some more water, muttered Nikolai Parfenovich.
Mitya took his hands away from his face and laughed. His look was cheerful. He had quite changed, as it were in a moment. And his whole tone was changed. Here now sat a man, once again the equal of all these men, of all these previous acquaintances of his, exactly as if they'd all come together the day before, when nothing had happened yet, somewhere at social gathering. Let us note, incidentally, that when he first came to our town, Mitya was warmly received at the commissioner's house, but later, especially during the last month, Mitya hardly ever visited him, and the commissioner, meeting him in the street, for example, frowned deeply and bowed to him only out of politeness, which circumstance Mitya noted very well. His acquaintance with the prosecutor was even more distant, but to the prosecutor's wife, a nervous and fantastic lady, he sometimes paid visits. Most respectful visits, by the way. He himself not even quite knowing why he was calling on her, and she always received him kindly, taking an interest in him for some reason, until quite recently. He had not yet had the time to make the acquaintance of the district attorney, though he had met him and even spoken with him once or twice, both times about the female sex.
You, Nikolai Parfenovich, are, I can see, a most skillful investigator, Mitya suddenly laughed gaily. But now I will help you myself. Oh, gentlemen, I am resurrected. I do not take it amiss that I addressed you so casually and directly. Besides, I'm a little drunk, but not that I will frankly, admit. I believe I had the honor and the pleasure of meeting you, Nikolai Parfenovich, at the home of my relation, Musov. Gentlemen, I do not claim to be equal. I quite understand who I am now, as I sit here before you. A horrible suspicion hangs over me. If Grigory has given evidence regarding me, then of course it hangs over me. Horrible, I quite understand, but to business, gentlemen, I'm ready, and now we'll make short work of it, because listen, gentlemen, you see, if I know I am not guilty, then of course we can make short work of it, can't we?
Mitya spoke much and quickly, nervously and expansively, as if he decidedly took his listeners for his best friend.
So for the present, we shall write down that you radically deny the accusation brought against you. Nikolai Parfenovich pronounced imposingly, and turning to the clerk, he dictated in a low voice what he was to write down.
Write down? You want to write it all down? Well, write it down then, I consent. I give you my full consent, gentlemen. Only you see... Wait. Write it down like this. Of violence, guilty. Of inflicting a savage beating on a poor old man, guilty. And then within himself... Oh, what? Within himself, too, inside in the bottom of his heart, he is guilty. But there is no need to write that down. He turned suddenly to the clerk. That is my private life, gentlemen, and that doesn't concern you now, the bottom of my heart, I mean. But of the murder of his old father, not guilty! It is a wild idea, it is an utterly wild idea. I'll prove it to you, and I'll be convinced, you'll be convinced immediately. You'll laugh, gentlemen. You'll roar with laughter at your own suspicions.
Calm yourself, Dmitri Fyodorovich, the district attorney reminded him, apparently as if he wished to subdue the frenzied man with his own calmness. By continuing the interrogation, I should like... If only you will agree to answer, to hear from you a confirmation of the fact that you seem to have disliked the late Fyodor Pavlovich and were in some sort of permanent dispute with him. Here, in any case, a quarter of an hour ago, I believe you were pleased to say that you even wanted to kill him. I did not kill him, you exclaimed. But I wanted to kill him.
I exclaimed it? Maybe I did, gentlemen. Yes, unfortunately, I wanted to kill him. Wanted to many times. Unfortunately.
You wanted to. Would you be willing to explain what principles, in fact, guided you in this hatred for the person of your parent?
What is there to explain, gentlemen? Mitya shrugged gloomily, looking down. I've never hidden my feelings. The whole town knows of it. Everyone in the tavern knows. Recently, in the monastery, I announced it to the elder Zosimusel. That same day, in the evening, I beat my father and nearly killed him and swore in front of the witnesses that I would come back and kill him. Oh, there's 1,000 witnesses. I've been shouting for the whole month. Everyone is a witness. The fact is there. The fact speaks. It cries out. But feelings, gentlemen, feelings are something else. You see, gentlemen. Mitya frowned. It seems to me that you have no right to question me about my feelings. You are empowered, I understand that. But this is my business, my inner business, an intimate thing. Since I've been hidden my intimate things before, in the tavern, for instance, but we have talked of it all and sundry, so I won't make a secret of it now either. You see, gentlemen, I quite understand that in that case there is a horrible evidence against me. I told everyone I would kill him, and suddenly he is killed. Who else but me in that case? Ha! I don't blame you, gentlemen, I don't blame you at all. I struck to the epidermis myself, because who finally did kill him in that case if not me? Isn't that so? If not me, then who? Who? Gentlemen, he suddenly exclaimed. I want to know! I even demand it of you! Gentlemen, where was he killed? How was he killed? With what and how? Tell me, he asked quickly, looking around at the prosecutor and the district attorney.
We found him lying on his back and on the floor of his study with his head smashed in, the prosecutor said.
How horrible, gentlemen! Mitya suddenly shuddered, and leaning his elbow on the table, he covered his face with his right hand.
Let us continue, Nikolai Parfenovich interrupted. What, then, guided you in your feeling of hatred? I believe you have announced publicly that it was a feeling of jealousy.
Yes, jealousy, but not only jealousy.
Disputes about money?
Yes, about money, too.
The dispute seems to have been over 3,000 rubles, allegedly due you as part of your inheritance.
3,000? Ha! It was more! More! Mitya heaved himself up. More than 6? Maybe more than 10, maybe. I told everyone. I shouted it to everyone, but I decided to let it go. To settle for 3,000. I desperately needed that 3,000. So the envelope with 3,000, which I knew was under his pillow, waiting for Grushenka, I considered definitely as stolen from me. That's what, gentlemen. I considered it mine, just as if it were my own property.
The prosecutor exchanged meaningful glances with the district attorney and managed to wink at him unobserved.
We shall come back to that subject later, the district attorney said at once. For now, allow me to take a note of precisely this little point and write it down, that you consider the money in that envelope as your own property.
Write it down, gentlemen. I quite understand that it is one more piece of evidence against me, but I'm not afraid of evidence and even testify against myself. Do you hear? Against myself. You see, gentlemen, you seem to be taking me for quite a different man from what I am. He suddenly added, glumly and sadly. It is a noble man you are speaking with, a most noble person, above all. Do not lose sight of this. A man who has...
Thank you for joining us on the Brothers Karamazov and Friends. Please join us next time for novels, novellas, and nihilists.